Antiquities and Treasure. I'm Clarissa Levy, Art and Heritage Council at Wedlake Bell.
And I'm Richard Harwood, I'm a barrister at 39 Essex Chambers.
And we're joined by Judith Newgee of Hornsby Newgee, who's an independent antiquities expert. Judith, you started your career in academia, and then for 24 years you were with Christie's in London, including as head of the antiquities department. And in 2009 you set up Hornsby and Newgee Limited with your colleague Sarah, advising on all aspects of antiquities. So as an independent valuer, you've worked on major historic and cultural finds, including the Staffordshire Hoard and the Galloway Hoard. And you advise the British Museum's Treasure Valuations Committee and provide treasure valuations for the UK government, Scotland and Ireland. So your expertise is in advising collectors and institutions in the commercial antiquities market through the years. And I was wondering if you could start by telling us some of the issues which are specific to the field of antiquities collecting.
Yes, of course. Well, it's a pleasure to be here today. Perhaps we should start by defining what we mean by antiquities for this particular purpose. In terms of the antiquities market, what we call antiquities is a vast field covering thousands of years. So you're looking at lots of different civilizations, or basically around the Mediterranean basin, but in essence, the Greek and Roman empires, ancient Egypt, Mesopotamia, so the ancient Near East, starting from the dawn of civilization or prehistory and going right up to the end of the Roman Empire through what we used to call the Dark Ages or the Migration Period and into the early medieval period. So you really are looking at thousands and thousands of years up to around about the 9th century AD. And then, of course, lots of different cultures. So as I mentioned, the Greeks and Romans, the Egyptians, Mesopotamians, but then the Vikings, the Anglo-Saxons, the Celts, and so on. So you're dealing with a very wide range of material in terms of time and place, but you're also dealing with a huge variety of different sorts of objects. I'm not a coin person, a numismatist, as they're called, but I deal only with objects and artifacts. But then you're dealing with things that are, on the one hand, microscopic and then monumental. So it could be a tiny fragment of a Roman ring one minute, and it could be a massive pillar from a temple the next, or an over-life-size sculpture. So that's one of the particularities of antiquities. The other thing is that many of these things are actually unique. So in terms of trying to value them or appreciate them, what do you do when there's only one of its kind in existence? That's a particular challenge for us as valuers and also experts trying to identify them. Another thing which is very topical with antiquities now is provenance, so the history of an object after it was found in the ground. Where has it been for the past 50 years, 100 years, 300 years, 400 years? And also authenticity. Is it actually ancient or is it a later copy or imitation? So those are some of the things that occupy us in the world of antiquities.
I was really also wondering, collecting antiquities has always been popular. Why so?
Collecting is not a new activity, as we all know. But even in the Republican Rome in the 2nd century, 1st century BC, you had auction houses and auctions going on to supply collectors who were desperate to get their hands on Greek material, even Roman material, precious things, cameos, gems, silverware. Why were they collecting? Well, partly perhaps because they liked the objects, but also it's very much linked to status and wealth. So if you were a self-respecting Roman in the 1st century BC, like Cicero, for example, you'd be trying to find a nice statuary for your Tuscan farmhouse, or you'd be having wonderful silverware on your sideboard to impress your dinner guests. So that's the case in antiquity. It then continued, really. It's the motivations, I think, don't really change over the millennia. People collect things because they're beautiful, they reflect well on their status and their prestige. But also, of course, they are of interest to scholars who are studying a particular field and who are trying to piece together our history and to understand it. So, for example, in the age of the Enlightenment, with the discovery of lots of Roman remains, for example, in the building being carried out in Rome in the 16th century, and all these things were coming to light, it was an endless source of fascination these interesting depictions of gods and goddesses, naked ladies, so things like this, and the study of new and foreign languages, the fascination with Egypt that started as a result of the Napoleonic expeditions in the late 18th century, transformed, I think, European taste. And then, of course, in the 18th century, the fashion for the English doing their grand tour around Italy and later Greece, they were collecting particularly sculptures, but also gems and ancient jewelry, things to show that they were people of cultivation, sophistication, and that they had good taste. That's been a sort of running theme. And today, well, all of the above, really. But there's also this thing about, as human beings, I think we are interested in our past. And when you can touch something which was last held by, I don't know, a Roman soldier who lost his button, or an Egyptian princess who was applying the kohl to her eyes 3,000 years ago, there's that thing of holding something which links you directly to ancient civilizations, whether they are your own or ones that intrigue you, is a very potent thing. And the other thing is, of course, antiquities remain quite affordable. You can collect on virtually any scale. You can buy a small Roman coin for very little, or a little Roman ring, or a Celtic brooch. And then you can, of course, go up to great treasures that cost millions. So there's something for everyone.
And you touched on provenance and the importance of that. So when this is where an object has come from, I'm always curious to know how you go about provenance research and what happens when you can't complete the ownership history of an object.
Yeah, so provenance research is becoming increasingly more important after the 1970 UNESCO Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property and so on. I think people, the market, museums, collectors became much more aware of the importance of distinguishing objects that have come from legitimate provenances and objects that might have been looted or come to light in an illegal fashion. Even in the 70s, in the 80s, and in the 90s, there was far less importance attached to provenance because it wasn't legally required. And you have the situation where now, if you're buying an antiquity, you would absolutely expect some sort of indication of where it's bought or when it was bought or how long it's been in a collection. Some things have been in collections since the 17th century or the 16th century. You have publications proving it. But in other cases, even, as I said, in the late 20th century, people weren't even bothering to write down where they bought something or even to keep an invoice if they had bought something. So this is problematic, and it's really important to try and trace an object's history to make sure that it's legal tender, if you like. Say, for example, you've inherited something from your great-grandfather, but you have nothing to prove that it was actually in his collection in the 1920s. You're a bit stuck. And the problem is that if you want to sell the object, some of the major auction houses won't take an object unless it has clear proof of ownership. Since before 2000, the year 2000, museums generally will require provenance that goes back to 1970 and beforehand. So being able to prove the ownership history is really important. The first port of call is really to ask to grill the owner and say, if this belonged to your grandfather, can you show me anything that might corroborate that? So you might be lucky. He might have kept an invoice. He might have bought it at some auction house or country house sale, and he might have kept the invoice. Marvelous. But he might not have done. And there may be actually nothing that the owner can think of. But sometimes you say, well, would you have a photograph? And sometimes you do have a photograph. They come across a nice little photograph taken wherever, children's party or whatever, and in the background is the Roman bust on the mantelpiece. And now that's terribly important. Or it could be that there's a piece of jewellery and it's in a case, and the case is made by a particular jeweller, and that jeweller went out of business in 1930. So you know that it dates from pre-1930. So it's really important to try and go through with the owner to try and check the story they're giving you and whatever physical evidence they might give to you. But then if that isn't going very well, you can also look at auction records. It's always important to cross-reference and to check any provenance they might give you. So, for example, something might be published in a catalogue. Well, you have to go back to the catalogue, check that all the information is correct. And in that catalogue, you might have a reference to something else. There might be a publication. In that publication, you could also find a footnote and with a reference to something else. So you follow the paper trail and always check the information. But of course, there's also following things up with auction houses or dealers, actually getting in touch with them and saying, do you have records of this? Do you remember? And sometimes people give us information in confidence, which they might not otherwise release so easily. That's also interesting. And then, of course, there's library work. So there are lots of archives in libraries, but increasingly online, very useful databases like the Arachne database for classical sculpture. So more and more online resources are available. And for example, famous historical collections and even collections from dealers and collectors and auction houses are increasingly finding their way to national institutions and libraries like the Smithsonian Library in the US, the National Gallery, the Getty Museum. They're accepting now donations, gifts of archives of private collectors and so on. So that's a really valuable resource.
It seems that the easiest ones to do are the items in the country houses where the second son went on the grand tour in the 18th century. And usually there's actually a pretty good record of how the antiquity was found or the 18th century copy was made.
That's the gift, isn't it?
Yeah. And then you sort of, often in the context of where they're fixed to things, and sometimes you'd be sort of tracing them through Victorian postcards and photographs in country life to spot them in the background.
Exactly.
Which is great fun. But in a sense, that's relatively easy on those particular items. Also, where there's not actually, usually the issue probably isn't more recent question, isn't it? But has this situation of looking at provenance changed over the last few decades from a historic view that, well, you may have an issue on ownership, but limitation periods, you're only looking back 6 years normally. You don't have to go that far back to establish that whoever's selling it has title, to the situations we have at the moment where that may be an issue purely on ownership, in a sense, but also whether it's been unlawfully excavated, whether there's been an unlawful export, and the moral issues which may well come in if legal ownership has passed. We discussed Holocaust exfoliation with Mishra Aronovich a few months ago on the podcast, but a whole series of often ethical issues relating to provenance as well as the legal ownership issues. Has that changed how you deal with the issues?
I think it has. There's more of an awareness nowadays of things being taken out of countries illegally. And of course, what happens also sometimes is that with scholarship that moves on, something that's been in a collection, for example, for 50 years, it suddenly, with an excavation in a country of origin, suddenly reveals that the type of object in that collection can only have come from a particular area. And so that's new knowledge, if you like, informing that this object may probably have come out of the country without her. And then there is the question of whether you want to try repatriation and so on, which is not easy. It's actually, depending on the countries, it can be very costly for the owner of the object to go through the process of trying to repatriate the object to its country of origin. And even then, is the country of origin in a state to receive the object and look after it properly?
Some of these moral questions come up in the world of treasure as well, which I'm very keen to ask you about. So to someone like me who's not familiar with the treasure rules, how would you explain what treasure is?
So what is treasure when we're talking about Britain and Ireland? Well, it's defined under the Treasure Act as any metallic object with at least 10% precious metal content, gold or silver, and is at least 300 years old when it's found. So that's one definition. So objects with 10% precious metal content, any group of two or more metallic objects of any composition of prehistoric date that come from the same find. So that's prehistoric finds don't have to have as much as 10% precious metal content. Then there's coins, which, as I said, I don't deal with, but coins, again, with 10% minimum precious metal content, as long as there are two found together, they're classed as treasure, or if there are 10 found together that are base metal, they're also classed as treasure. And then any object, whatever it's made of, that is found in the same place as or has previously been associated with another object that's been classed as treasure. So that's the actual definition. It's basically stuff that's under the ground that's over 300 years old and has some precious metal content. So there's an enormous amount of this material around, a huge amount, absolutely huge amount of treasure, and people come across it sometimes by chance. I remember an Anglo-Saxon beautiful gold disc pendant that was brought to me when I was at Christie's in the mid-1980s. And it had been found by somebody on the Isle of Sheppey, just in the shingle. He thought it was a gold bottle top and he put it in his pocket and it stayed in a matchbox for about 25 years until he saw a programme on the television about the Anglo-Saxons and he thought, aha. So he brought it to Christie's. I identified it as an absolutely magnificent gold disc brooch. It was sold and it's now in the Ashmolean Museum. So those are chance finds. But then, of course, there's a huge amount of interest in metal detecting, particularly since that's really developed since the 1970s. So there are an awful lot of people going out specifically to find material.
I'm curious because the experience that I have had most recently professionally with treasure, it wasn't actually treasure at all, the object, although it could have been because it was Scotland, which has different rules or had different rules. And what I'm curious about is that object was made of ivory. But it seems to me that from what you've just said, metal is the thing. Metal seems to be an important
component.
So if you've got an object made of stone, a work of art carved into an ancient piece of stone or bone or something, that can't be treasure.
Well, it can be if it's found in association which something is classed as treasure. So, for example, something with some part of metallic content. But at the same time, the laws have recently been amended to try and cover things that don't have precious metal content. So to get round, for example, the Crosby Garrett helmet, which was made of copper alloy, bronze, basically, with tinned lead, had no silver or gold. So therefore, it didn't come under treasure laws. But even so, the regulations are such that it is still dependent on some metal content. So, for example, if it's at least 200 years old and it is at least partially made of metal. So it is a bit strange. It is a bit strange.
And can you explain the portable antiquity scheme? It might be quite a big question, that. But what's that and how is it different from treasure?
So the portable antiquity scheme was set up in order to deal with treasure, but also really its main function was to record archaeological finds found by the public, to educate and promote knowledge and understanding of archaeological finds and treasure, and to help people report their finds. So what it really is a network around 40 finds liaisons officers. They're based in museums and archaeological services all around England and Wales, and 6 national finds advisors. And all of these people are administered by a central unit in the British Museum. So their role is to go out and help people, be a port of call for people to come and report their finds, and then they can add them to this extraordinary database. So the Portable Antiquities Scheme runs a database which now has over 1.5 million objects on it, which is an absolutely extraordinary resource, not just for the public, but also for archaeologists. And something doesn't have to be classed as treasure to be put on the database. It's finds in general. So this is absolutely marvellous. In the process, of course, the finds liaisons officers will help the public identify whether their object might be treasure or not, and will facilitate the reporting of such an object to the coroner, because there is a strict process here. If you find something that you suspect might be made of treasure, you either declare it to the finds liaison officer or you declare it to the coroner. But normally you'd be in touch with the finds liaison officer, who might send it up to the British Museum, record it, might send it up to the British Museum. It might have scientific analysis. A coroner will then decide whether it does fall under the category of treasure. And if that's the case, it goes before the Treasure Valuations Committee, who then will commission a commercial valuation from someone like me. And then eventually, once the valuation is arrived at and agreed on by the landowner, the finder, the Treasure Valuations Committee, it will then be purchased by a museum or an institution. Or if there's no museum that either wants it or wants to raise or can raise the money for it, it will be returned to the finder.
So if I find something that is just out of this world tremendously valuable and simply no one's got the cash to buy it, much as the nation would love to display it, then I get to keep it.
You get to keep it.
Cool.
It's quite interesting because with the proliferation of finds, for example, in the last 20 years, the number of precious metal finds has completely exploded. And particularly, say, 20 years ago, a Bronze Age gold armlet might have been extremely rare to come across. Well, now there have been quite a few finds, and you do get the situation where the local museum just cannot raise the funds to buy something that's valued at £80,000 or £100,000.
Can we look at the success of the Portable Antiquities Scheme? Because from the 1970s, when metal detecting really got underway, there seemed to be a clash between the detectorists and the archaeologists, the concern of the archaeologists being that items were being dug up, and first of all, the items were not getting known about, but also that the sites where they're found, which may have archaeological interest, would get disrupted by amateurs who don't record it. The Portable Antiquities Scheme, I understand, was a way of trying to sort of bring those two sides together so that things were being reported, they were properly being dealt with, and also, if you know where something's from, there may then be either protection for the site or more archaeological evaluation done of the site.
Yes, absolutely, and you're absolutely right to raise this, because there was an enormous amount of bad feeling and suspicion between archaeologists and metal detectorists. Certainly when I joined Christie's, I came across a couple of rather unpleasant cases, in fact. But I did actually meet a wonderful archaeologist called Tony Gregory, who was very enlightened. He was working in Norfolk. And what he put in place was really the model for the Portable Antiquities Scheme, in that he was trying to work with metal detectorists, encourage them to bring their finds forward, trying to break down the barrier between the archaeologists and the metal detectors, and trying to make them feel valued as opposed to the scum of the earth. And while a lot has been done to break down that sort of mutual suspicion, there still does remain quite a lot of hostility in certain cases. But it really has been completely transformed by the Portable Antiquity Scheme, where you can see that the finders are actually being enlisted on certain archaeological digs to help to widen the scope. The other thing is that when they make their finds and they declare them straight away to the finds liaison officers, you can then, for example, have fascinating and terribly important information about the context in which the find has been made. The joke is that the finder is interested in the object because he loves objects, and the archaeologist doesn't care a hoot for the object, just wants the context. There is a sort of gradation, but it has really changed. And so, for example, I mean, the Peebles hoard, which I might mention later, which was found by a metal detectorist in Scotland in the first lockdown, he was so excited but realised how important it was. He declared it immediately. I'm not quite sure whether it was a fine liaison offer, probably the museum, in fact. But then he actually set up his tent and camped to protect the site because he was so worried that it might be found by someone else and disturbed, looted. And it turned out to be one of the most important metalwork Bronze Age hoards ever found in Scotland. And the same thing happened also with the Dumfries and Galloway hoard. Straight away, it was declared, and archaeologists moved in and spent the next 3 years finding more objects. Staffordshire hoard, the same. I mean, actually, Terry Herbert, who found it, did spend 5 days gathering objects, but he did declare it. And again, archaeological excavations were carried on for several years afterwards, and another approximately 1,600 objects when I examined it. Another 1,500 odd objects were found by the archaeologists on the site afterwards. So immensely valuable.
What have those finds taught us, and what have we learnt from those?
It's almost limitless, the amount that's being discovered through these finds and hoards. A lot of it is things that are found in Britain at a time when there isn't very much written record. And so all you have is material finds. And when you actually find groups of objects or hoards that teach you about cultural crossovers, connections, things found at a time and a place where you would think there is no connection with the outer world, with continental Europe, it is really quite astonishing. The Staffordshire hoard, which was found in 2009, as the most important discovery of Anglo-Saxon treasure ever, was very intriguing, and it continues to be worked on, and discoveries that continue to be made, because there was things like, it was the first hoard of its type that didn't have any domestic objects or anything associated with women. It was very much military objects, 3 religious items as well, but also objects that had never been seen before. We still don't have any idea what they were used for. The Dumfries and Galloway hoard, which was again the most important Viking hoard uncovered to date, had a unique range of objects. very rare object when they were buried round about 900 AD. It was an accumulation of objects that spanned several hundred years. And the analysis of the textile and silk, the organic material that surrounded the main vessel that was found, the layer of the Viking silver that was found at the top, but then this extraordinary lidded cup that contained an astonishing array of gold and silver objects, including brooches that were unknown in type, an extraordinary gold pin with a sort of aquatic bird at the top. There is no parallel for that at all. Very intriguing objects made, so one particular one made of rock crystal that had been then repurposed and wound with gold and encased with a sort of gold casing to make it into a sort of flask. We still don't know exactly its use, but it seems to be rock crystal that might date for the late Roman Empire period and then reused as a very special object and a precious object, rock crystal being very, very precious. And there's, you know, a whole host of other objects in these hoards which defy our understanding, but with analysis will teach us a lot more about trade links, transport links during the time, and also cultural links.
And showing there were collectors of antiquities in the Dark Ages.
Well, absolutely. What we call the Dark Ages is now more commonly known the Migration Period. But again, very little was known because there's very little written record. And the thing about these finds is that as well as being magnificent treasures, they're also everyday objects. So the things that are learnt from the everyday objects are almost more important to archaeologists and historians. When you have written record, it tends to tell you about princes and aristocrats and church people and people of high status. It doesn't tell you how many buttons were on a Roman soldier's tunic. And these finds that are being made are showing us where people were travelling, what they were carrying with them, the fact that they might actually have things on them that are precious relics that they've kept. So a picture of history emerges, which you just simply wouldn't have otherwise at all. So really, the material finds are completely changing our understanding of history. The Sutton Hoo ship burial that was found in 1939 was the first material evidence of this sort of rather mythical society that's described in the epic poem Beowulf. There was this talk of these aristocrats and their great halls and their shield and their helmets. And for the first time, a helmet was found, or remains of a helmet, that was exactly described in the Beowulf epic. For the first time, people thought, this society actually had some basis in reality. And similarly, with the Staffordshire hoard, with the Galloway hoard, you have these objects that are evidence of something going on that we were unaware of. Until the Staffordshire hoard, for example, only about 10 gold sword pommels, so that's the bit on the top of your sword, the handle of your sword, only about 10 had been found throughout 20 years of the portable antiquities scheme. In this one find, you've got, is it 69 gold pommels? So until then, you only found 10 over a number of 15 years. And then suddenly in one spot, you've got 69. So where you thought, we must have had n number of aristocrats who had been wealthy enough to have this sword, suddenly you're thinking, well, all of this is turned on its head. So our understanding of history, of society, of what was going on, is being transformed.
I think we're both speechless.
Yeah, actually, I'd say exactly that we are.
I'm not an archaeologist nor a historian, so what I'm saying is a bit rambly in general, but it is really fascinating. For example, one of the finds that I dealt with at Christie's was the Oxborough dirk. Now, this is a Bronze Age enormous ritual sword blade, if you like. It was never meant to be used. It was made for ritual purposes. And a man literally stumbled across it in a forest. He was walking along and he tripped over the top of it. So it had been buried vertically in the ground. So it turned out this was an absolutely astonishing ceremonial dirk. Only 6 are known to ever to have existed so far. 2 were found in Britain, 2 were found in the Netherlands, and 2 were found in France. And through research and study of these things, and this one was found in 1988, we now know that they all came from the same workshop. So was that workshop in continental Europe? Most probably. But to be able to understand that this distribution of these extraordinary ceremonial ritual swords, it's really fascinating. So yes, what we discover, I mean, the Peebles hoard, which was this Bronze Age hoard of copper alloy objects, really associated with a horse harness that is providing an enormous amount of interest, obviously, to archaeologists and historians, because nothing has ever been found like it. And the particularly interesting thing about that hoard was that it had a lot of textile, organic material, preserved. So that's really unusual, because usually things from that date, late Bronze Age period, so we're talking about 1000 BC, 1000 to 800 BC, mostly wood, textile, leather, deteriorates, none of it surviving. Whereas this actually had a sword still in its scabbard, and it had all these mysterious bronze rings and a strange sort of harness, and the leather straps and the wood was still preserved. So an enormous amount of scientific analysis can result from that. And in fact, although somebody described it as Bronze Age bling, because these marvelous sort of rattle pendants for the front of the horse's harness, but actually one of the curators, Dr. Matthew Knight, who's in charge of the Bronze Age, he thought that one of the most exciting finds of the hoard was a trace of thread, which was attached to a button, because of course we don't usually have any organic material associated with such. So you can then analyse where the thread comes from, how it was made, and so on and so forth. On the Galloway hoard, there was an extraordinary amount of textile, again, very unusually preserved. So it's Anglo-Saxon, it's later, we're talking about a deposition of 900 AD. But fascinatingly, buried round about 900, but there's a woolen textiles and silk textiles that date to 200 years earlier that are wrapping the chalice. And they come from Byzantium. They come from Constantinople, which is way over in Turkey. So some of these objects have come from very far afield. In fact, the chalice, which was first thought to be probably Merovingian, so from continental Europe, was later understood, looking at the iconography, to have Zoroastrian symbols on it. And finally, so indicating that it would come from more an area like Iran. And then, in fact, analysis of the silver shows that the silver does come from a region in Iran, mines in Iran. So you've got this object that's come from Asia that's containing all sorts of objects, including Anglo-Saxon silver, this very intriguing and unique objects, and then these strange little pellets of earth right at the bottom that, again, have been wrapped up in textiles. So they're all very precious. These pellets of earth, what are they doing in a group of gold and silver treasure? Well, are they possibly things like used to be the case that pilgrims going to religious sites would gather up the earth and make little mud balls as a sort of relic of the site? Is that what they are? There's still an enormous amount of research work to be done, but it paints a picture of what's going on, which is very interesting.
Judith, this whole conversation has been treasure. I could listen to you all day talk about the memorable cases you've worked on and all the things that we can learn in this field. And just want to thank you so much for giving us so much food for thought and sharing a tiny fraction of your knowledge with us.
Thank you for listening to the Art and Heritage Law Contested Heritage. Please do follow or subscribe on Apple or Spotify podcasts to enjoy more shows.
We have a new podcast out every fortnight. If you're able, please take the time to rate us and put down a review.
The show is also on the 39 Essex Chambers website, along with podcast series on topics such as artificial intelligence, climate change, and planning.